I've recently joined the free app Stereo, and each week I've been doing live streams about true crime. And even more exciting, I'm doing true crime quizzes as well. Stereo is a live social conversation app where you can be a co-host, part of the conversation, or simply just listen. It's completely free to download in the App Store, and if you tune into my live streams, you can be part of it by talking with me directly during the live feed. Stereo is completely audio-based, so you don't use your camera. You can literally join in while in your sweatpants in bed, and nobody would have a clue. So join me over on the Stereo app, check out my schedule, and join in. Download the Stereo app and follow me at stereo.com/morbidology. The link is in the description. That's stereo.com/morbidology. Welcome to Morbidology. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, Mysteries Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join Morbidology on Patreon for exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, exclusive merch, ad-free and early release episodes, and much more. It was a cold winter morning in Cleveland, Ohio, when a teenage girl vanished after getting on a public transit bus to take her to school. Her parents didn't learn that she was missing until later on that afternoon. Her disappearance sparked a massive search and would lead to calls for safer streets and for new legislation when it comes to schools reporting children as absent. It would also lead many parents to question if their child was really safe when travelling to school alone, and ponder what kind of monsters could be lurking around abandoned buildings. Aliana DeFries was a 14-year-old girl from Cleveland, Ohio. She was a 7th grader at E Prep and Village Prep Woodland Hills, where she was known as a gentle and kind person. Each morning, she would burst through the doors of the classroom and greet her classmates in a sing-song voice, simply to put a smile on their faces. She lived at home with her mother, Denisha Cooper, and her 2-year-old brother. Denisha and Aliana's father, Damon DeFries, had separated when Aliana was younger, but she was still very close with both of them. Aliana loved the movies Frozen and Finding Nemo, and enjoyed collecting Glitz dolls. On the 26th of January 2017, Aliana was reported missing by her mother. She had called up the school and spoke with the dean about an upcoming parent-teacher conference, and while on the phone, she was informed that Aliana had never shown up to school that morning. Immediately, Denisha's stomach sank. That morning, she had walked Aliana to the 3400 block of East 149th Street, where she got on a public transit bus to take her to school. Security footage then captured Aliana getting off the bus at East 93rd and Kinsman and crossing the street at approximately 6:50 a.m. Typically, Aliana would take the 20-minute bus ride and then transfer to another bus. To get to the other bus, Aliana would walk past a number of dilapidated houses that had become a common feature in Cleveland. From here, Aliana was spotted on CCTV walking in the direction of a nearby McDonald's, but seemingly she never made it there and never made it to school. Somewhere along the way, Aliana vanished. A missing person report described Aliana as 5 feet 2 inches tall and around 119 pounds. Cleveland police officers had patrol officers, detectives, and a lieutenant assigned to the case, and eventually the Cleveland FBI were called in to assist. They canvassed the neighborhoods and spoke with residents. Aliana had intellectual disabilities, which made her extremely trusting of people, and she could be easily persuaded. As her aunt, Arielle Bell, said, "She's never been in any kind of trouble. There's no reason for her to run away from home, so this is very, very unlike her. The fact she's been gone this long, it's never happened before." Aliana was on a special education track at school and acted much younger than her 14 years. She still played with dolls and children's toys. E-Prep and Village Prep Woodland Hills is a breakthrough school, and all of the breakthrough schools used a recently implemented automated phone call and message system to notify parents when a child is absent. It would soon be discovered that when Aliana didn't show up to school that morning, the school had used the message system to inform Aliana's family of her absence. However, due to a software malfunction, the message was never delivered, meaning that Denisha didn't know her daughter didn't arrive at school until she phoned the school. A spokesperson for the school said that they were heartbroken to discover that an error in their system had led to the delay in Denisha being notified of Aliana's absence, and said that they would be making manual attendance calls until they had full confidence in the software that they used. They announced that they would also be investigating why the glitch had occurred. Just 2 days later, a body would be discovered by investigators working on the case. The body was found in an abandoned house on Fuller Avenue at around 7:30 p.m. It was just around the corner from where Aliana was seen getting off the bus. Investigators had been searching yards and abandoned homes in the area when they made the grim discovery. The body was that of a female, and she was transported to the medical examiner's office for an identification and a cause of death to be determined.
We have a very strong idea, based on evidence and things like that, of who that person is. And we've talked to that family. We're in constant contact with that family. But until the medical examiner makes that positive identification, we don't have an announcement.
And it's absolutely essential, as the chief said, to bring these folks to justice, individual or individuals to justice, and we have to get all of the details right.
Just the following day, medical examiner Thomas Gilson said during a news conference that the body found was consistent with that of Aliana. However, he said he would not definitively identify the body until more DNA and fingerprint comparisons were completed. It wouldn't be long until the body was positively identified as Aliana. The medical examiner's office would also announce that her death was being treated as a homicide. Aliana had been beaten and stabbed to death. The FBI and the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation were called in to assist in the case, while a $22,500 reward was put forward for information that could lead to Aliana's killer. They held a press conference during which they were asked by a member of the public if a serial killer was stalking their community, to which Police Chief Calvin Williams said that they were going to be comparing evidence in the case to evidence in other cases for commonalities. The area where Aliana's body was found was an extremely run-down area, with abandoned homes dotted throughout the neighbourhoods. Cleveland Councilman Zach Reed said he feared that the discovery of Aliana may signal a trend. He stated, "This is the fifth body found near the 93rd Street corridor since 2012. Four of the bodies have been dumped in vacant lots or abandoned homes. Please tell me there's no obvious connection between the murders, but I'm not so sure. How do we know that we don't have another serial killer out there?" The councilman certainly had a reason to fear the worst. Over the years preceding Aliana's murder, there had been two infamous crime sprees which went undetected for years. In 2009, Anthony Soyle was arrested in Cleveland, and the bodies of 11 women were discovered at his home on Imperial Avenue. While in 2013, Ariel Castro was arrested after abducting and holding three women captive for over a decade, before one managed to escape. On the 1st of February, the community held a vigil for Aliana. The community rallied behind her heartbroken family as they gathered on Fuller Avenue, near where the body was discovered. her aunt Ariel Bell said. Our family is so broken, we cannot understand how someone could be so evil, so monstrous to a child. She was just a baby. She didn't deserve this. She didn't deserve to go with no family there, all alone in this house, cold. Fourth District Police Commander Brandon Cutts was in attendance and told the crowd that they were working alongside the FBI and that they were working non-stop to try and seek justice for Aliana. They were currently in the process of reviewing CCTV footage from around the area, as well as conducting sweeps in the neighbourhood to speak with anybody who may have seen Aliana or may have seen something suspicious. Just the following day, it was announced that there had been an arrest in the case. At 7:15 p.m, 44-year-old Christopher Whittaker had been arrested on Mayfield Road in Mayfield Heights and taken into custody on charges of kidnapping and aggravated murder. Cleveland Police Chief Calvin Williams announced that Christopher had been identified as the suspect in the murder through evidence which had been discovered in the medical examiner's office. However, he didn't immediately elaborate. Media outlets would scramble to try and uncover more about Christopher, as it would soon be publicly revealed he had a lengthy criminal record. In 1996, he was charged with burglary and later pleaded guilty to criminal trespass after he crawled through a window to steal a television in Maple Heights. The resident was in the home and fled outside. 3 years later, he was convicted of breaking into the home of a family member and stealing her car. His records would also show that he was a convicted sex offender who had registered with the sheriff's deputies the same address for years. However, it would show that sheriff's deputies had not gone to his address to verify that he was still living there since early 2015. Christopher had been placed on the sex offenders registry in 2005, after he choked, sexually assaulted, and then stabbed a woman in the neck with scissors in Bedford Heights. In that case, he had called this woman several times throughout the night, before going to her apartment and asking if he could use her bathroom. The 45-year-old woman let Christopher into her apartment. He entered her bathroom and then emerged with a pair of scissors. He had initially been charged with attempted murder and rape, but then struck a plea deal for sexual battery and felony assault, and a 4-year prison sentence. His most recent conviction had stemmed from a 2013 burglary. In that case, he broke into his ex-girlfriend's home on Ledgewood Drive, Bedford, and stole 3 televisions, a CD player, a fax machine, a computer, a washer, and a cell phone. The woman also reported that Christopher had stolen her car. Several days after the robbery, Christopher called the woman and threatened to kill her unless she recanted her statement to police. He pleaded guilty to grand theft and was initially sentenced to 2 years on probation. However, he violated this probation by taking drugs and was then sentenced instead to 6 months in jail. Following his release, Christopher continued to call and threaten the woman. He also threatened her on Facebook, sending her messages threatening to kill her family. His records would also show that he certainly knew the area where Aliana's body had been found. He had lived in an apartment just steps away from the abandoned home where she was found. While E-Prep and Village Prep Woodland Hills had attempted to contact Denisha to inform her that Aliana hadn't arrived at school that morning, the discovery of Aliana's body would prompt calls for a new state law which would require that schools notify parents immediately if their child is absent from school. Under the laws at the time, schools weren't required to do this. They had to decide on their own whether they notified a parent when their child did not show up to school. Keisha Taylor, a Cleveland Heights mother, created a petition calling for a new law which she wanted to name the Aliana Alert. State Senator Sandra Williams, who represented District 42, which was where Aliana disappeared from, announced that she would start the process of drafting a new law, stating, "This could be a first step to helping the parents take action before something happens." On the Saturday after Christopher's arrest, a march was organized by Black on Black Crime Incorporated, which was an African American Federation Association who worked as a support group for families affected by violence. They wanted to thank the Cleveland police officers from the 4th District for the work they had done in identifying and arresting a suspect in Aliana's murder. The crowd gathered at Cleveland's 4th District Police Headquarters, where they were greeted by police officers. They shook hands, exchanged hugs, and cried together. They then marched to the abandoned home where Aliana's body was discovered. They brought along flowers, teddies, and trinkets, and placed them outside the derelict home. As one mourner said, they wanted Aliana to know that they all loved her and were showering her with love. However, Aliana's grandmother, Evelyn Day, requested that the teddy bears and toys instead be distributed to the children in the neighborhood. The abandoned home had become a makeshift memorial, but understandably, while the items had been left with love, Aliana's family didn't want the home to become a place where Aliana was to be remembered. They said that they appreciated the outpouring of support, but they wanted Aliana to be remembered in the places that she loved, not at the house where she was murdered. They asked that the teddy bears and toys be distributed to children, or for them instead to be left at Aliana's school, or any other place that she loved. Meanwhile, Christopher appeared in court for his first arraignment. The prosecutor would reveal more insight into the murder. He accused Christopher of following Aliana from the bus stop that morning. He stated that Christopher kidnapped and brutally assaulted and murdered her, taking the life of a beautiful little girl. He said that this, combined with Christopher's lengthy criminal record, were indications that a high bond be necessary. Christopher's public defender, Antonio Nicholson, opposed to the high bond, stating that a $1 million bond would be more appropriate, because his client was most likely not going to get out of jail anyway. Ultimately, Judge Michael Slawinski set Christopher's bond at $3 million. As talk of a serial killer quivered in the air, it was announced that Christopher's DNA would be tested against DNA in the CODIS Cold Case Crimes Database. There were a number of unsolved murders of women in Cleveland, and some suspected that Christopher could have been involved. The murder of Aliana was extremely brutal, and some feared that she may not have been his first victim. Cleveland Councilman Zach Reed cited 4 unsolved murders in the 93rd that they wanted to look into. Jasmine Trotter and Ashley Lesieski were murdered between the 22nd of March and the 28th of May in 2013, and were both discovered within a mile and a half of where Aliana was found. Christine Malone was found murdered on the 23rd of March in a building around 2 blocks away from where Aliana was found. And then Jamila Hasson was found murdered on the 17th of December 2012 in an abandoned home around half a mile away from where Aliana was found. However, it would quickly be determined that when 2 of these murders had occurred, Christopher was in jail, while in the other 2 cases he was days away from being arrested on a burglary charge. Furthermore, his DNA didn't come back as a match to any unsolved case which had DNA collected. Following the announcement, Cleveland Counsel Zach Reed said that he did not regret sparking fears of a serial killer, and revealed that in the past he had actually reported to police the smell of dead bodies near the home of Anthony Soyle, who I mentioned earlier in this episode. Despite his report, Anthony was not investigated until months later. Zach Reed said, "It's still concerning that there are 4 unsolved murders of women on East 93rd. We need to find out what is the lure to 93rd, and why do these horrific crimes happen here? Why do they feel like they can come here and do that?" It's easy to become overwhelmed and confused by all of the variations of teeth whitening that are out there on the market. Well, today's episode is sponsored by the amazing Smile Brilliant. They've taught me some useful information that alleviates some of that confusion, such as, did you know that LED lights are simply a novelty item? That strip lights neglect the gum lines, crevices, and molars? The charcoal is abrasive and wears down the enamel, and that whitening toothpaste only works on surface stains? Dentists always recommend that the number one product is a custom-fitted tray. However, they're super expensive and require a dentist to make them by hand, with a model of your teeth. That's where Smile Brilliant comes in. With Smile Brilliant's lab direct process, you can have custom fitted teeth whitening trays at a fraction of the price without ever going to the dentist. They will use an exact model of your teeth to handcraft you a personalized tray, ensuring the best possible result. All you do is make your own dental impressions at home and then return them to Smile Brilliant using the prepaid envelope they provide. It really couldn't be simpler and is a fraction of the price of the dentist. Just head on over to smilebrilliant.com or click the link in my show notes and use promo code Morbidology for 30% off. Aliana's family now had the crushing task of preparing her funeral. The community had truly come together to try and bring Aliana home safely. And then, when that was shattered, they came together to seek justice and provide support and love for her family. Aliana's family would announce that her funeral and wake were going to be open to the public, and asked that if anybody wanted to send flowers, then send them to Lucas Funeral Home in Garfield Heights. The wake was scheduled for 12 p.m. to 12:30 p.m. at New Spirit Revival Centre in Cleveland Heights on the 11th of February, and her funeral would be immediately afterwards. However, just days later, it was announced that Aliana's family would need to find a new venue for the funeral, after New Spirit Revival Centre said that they didn't have enough staff to open the event centre, and that there was some kind of hiccup in getting the funds for the funeral from the GoFundMe account, which was set up after Aliana's murder. Aliana's cousin, Heather Hall, said that the church said they would hold the space and they could pay them on the Wednesday when the funds were released. However, they then called on the Tuesday demanding the money before saying the space was no longer available, as if the family didn't have enough to be worrying about. But thankfully, the Imani Temple Ministries on North Taylor Road stood up to the plate and offered their venue and services for free. Thomas Boddy, the operations director, said, "That's what we do as a church. When the community needs us, we're there for them." The Imani Temple Ministries wasn't the only church to offer help in the wake of Aliana's murder. In fact, her murder would raise concerns about the safety of students either walking or using public transport to and from the school, and would prompt patrols. Mount Pleasant Ministerial Alliance would launch a Safe Schools initiative, which consisted of pastors from different churches in the area, patrolling a strip of East 93rd Street as children went to and from school. A number of pastors spoke with Cleveland News.
"So the pastors of this community have come out this morning, will be out every morning in the darkness of the morning to make sure our young people are safe as they go and get a quality education in Cleveland, Ohio.
People in the community from these churches can all commit an hour a week to come walk with our kids to make them feel safe. And we know that it takes a village to raise a child. We are the village."
They were hoping to recruit at least 25 churches to participate in the program, so that they could have a rotating schedule to ensure that schools had patrols every morning for the forthcoming months. A lot of parents didn't have the luxury of taking their child to and from school each day, and this would put a lot of parents' minds at ease. On the 11th of February, Aliana's funeral was held. Police escorted her body from Lucas Funeral Home to the Imani Temple Ministries. Her casket was situated at the front of the church, surrounded in flowers and photographs. The praise dancers from the Cleveland School of the Arts paid tribute with a dance while Aliana's aunt read out a letter written in memory of Aliana by her grandfather. It read, "The 14 years you were here, you gave me and your grandmother so much happiness. How you made your grandpa laugh when he was down and teased him when you were done. How I'm going to miss all of the warm and loving hugs you gave me." Many mourners wore purple, which was Aliana's favourite colour. Afterwards, she was buried during a private ceremony. Just the following day, prosecutors announced that they would be seeking the death penalty against Christopher, adding that more charges had been filed against him, including rape, kidnapping, offences against a human corpse, burglary, and tampering with evidence. Christopher would subsequently plead not guilty to all of the charges. Towards the end of the month, Denisha spoke publicly for the first time about what had happened to her daughter. She was holding Aliana's favourite stuffed animal named Cooper, as she said, "I don't understand how anyone can take away a sweet, innocent child like Aliana." She said that she'd be going to every court hearing so that Christopher could see her face, adding that while she hated to say it, she wanted Christopher to suffer for what he did to her daughter. She also said that she didn't like Aliana getting a public transit bus to and from school each day, but she felt a bit more comfortable due to the fact that one stop was in front of Cleveland's 4th District Police Station. However, Aliana's body had been found just 2 blocks away from this police station. Denisha and her mother, Yvonne Day, said that they were calling for more school buses in the area, so the children don't need to rely on public transit buses. Throughout the city, there were children just like Aliana getting a public transit bus to and from school each morning, and many were walking to these buses and getting on these buses when it was still dark outside. The Cleveland School District provides school bus transportation for students in pre-kindergarten through to 6th grade for those who live more than a mile away from school, while private schools offered a limited school bus transportation for the students. Other children, however, had to rely on public transport. Sadly for Denisha, on top of the trauma of losing her daughter, she had ended up living in a homeless shelter after her landlord stopped paying for running water. She moved in with relatives, and a church group said that they would put together a drive to collect funds to help Denisha and her 2-year-old son. Organisers at the church set up a fund called Denisha's Angels, and they asked anybody who wanted to donate to please do so at any key bank. The following month, Senator Sandra Williams proposed the truancy bill, which would require schools to contact parents immediately if a child is absent from school. The proposed law, called Aliana Alert, was introduced to the state capitol, and Denisha was there at the introduction and detailed her daughter's disappearance to the Senate Education Committee and said that if she had been properly informed, the search for Aliana would have begun a lot quicker. The murder trial began almost a year to the day that Aliana vanished. Outside of court, her father, Damon, said that he did not want to be in the same room as Christopher and said that no verdict or sentence would bring him closure. He said that time apparently heals all wounds, but this was a wound that would never heal. During the opening statements, prosecutors said that Aliana was alive when the majority of the injuries were inflicted on her, adding that Christopher had confessed to the murder to investigators during a recorded interview, which would be played out during trial. Christopher's defense team, during their opening statements, said that he would not be denying the charges against him. Defense attorney Thomas Shinezi said that they would be focusing instead on the penalty phase of the trial and would be trying to save Christopher from a death sentence. One of the first witnesses to testify was Denisha, and she spoke proudly of her daughter and said that she wasn't a typical teenager because she acted much younger and still enjoyed the things that little children would enjoy.
Can you describe her for us? What kind of personality she had?
She was bubbly and happy. Very quiet.
She's 14, she's a teenager, right? She gave you the typical teenager angst? She gave you problems like typical teenagers give people?
No, she was yelling at her age.
What do you mean by that?
She still played baby dolls. And she liked children who were younger than her, like the babies and things like that. So she wasn't a typical teenager.
She took the jury through the last morning of Aliana's life. They followed their typical weekday routine. Denisha described how she walked Aliana to the bus stop at around 6:30 a.m. that morning. Aliana was wearing her school uniform and she kissed her mother on the cheek before climbing onto the bus. This was the last time that Denisha ever saw her daughter, alive. Her voice quivered with emotion as she described the flurry of emotion and panic which overtook her when she learned that her daughter had not shown up to school that morning. Following her testimony, CCTV footage would be presented, which prosecutors said showed the moment that Aliana encountered Christopher just before her murder. CCTV footage taken at 7 a.m. at True Gospel Missionary Baptist Church on East 93rd at Fuller Avenue captured Christopher pacing along the street for several hours, and then captured Aliana being stopped by Christopher outside the church. Aliana can be seen taking a step back from Christopher, who then followed her northbound on the street. A short time later, footage captured Christopher leading Aliana through a field towards Fuller Avenue, near where her body would be found days later. Cleveland Police Officer Willie Hodges testified that he and his partner were assigned to check vacant houses in the area near where Aliana had vanished. When they approached the house where her body would be found, they noticed that the back door was laying wide open. When they entered the house, they noticed a trail of blood leading from the living room towards a closed door. He told the jury that his partner then kicked open the door and saw Aliana's body, naked except for a pair of socks. She was surrounded in a puddle of blood, and it was evident that she had sustained wounds to the back of her head and to her eye. He testified, "It definitely looked like she was dragged from one room to the other and just thrown into the other room." They also found Aliana's clothing and school bag inside the home, as well as bloody tools, including a drill, box cutter, and a hammer. It would be revealed during the trial that these tools had been used to inflict a number of fatal wounds on Aliana. The tools had been entered as evidence, and Assistant Prosecutor Mahmoud Awadalla presented them to the jury. They were shown a Black and Decker drill, a Phillips head screwdriver, a nut driver, and box cutter, as well as bloody pieces of Aliana's school uniform and her bra. They were then shown graphic photographs of puncture wounds to Aliana's face and head which matched the tools. He said that the drill matched 4 puncture wounds to Aliana's cheek and a wound to her forehead, which dislodged her right eyeball from its socket. The box cutter also matched several wounds to Aliana's neck. He revealed that a number of wounds showed signs of healing, which indicated that Aliana was alive for several hours after the wounds were inflicted. While Aliana's cause of death had already been publicly released, nobody knew the full extent of her murder, and it was even more disturbing than anybody could have ever fathomed. Medical examiner Dr. David Linnock, who performed the autopsy on Aliana, would take the jury through the plethora of injuries that were inflicted on her. He said that there were so many severe injuries that he could not identify which one specifically caused her death. He also said that her injuries were consistent with the tools that were found in the abandoned home. Jerry Oblock, a DNA analyst, then told the jury that Christopher's DNA had been found on Aliana's body.
In the absence of an identical twin, Christopher Whitaker is the source of the major DNA component in this mixture to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty.
A bloody footprint was also found inside the home, which matched Christopher's shoes. It would be revealed during trial that later on that morning, Christopher had helped David Bruton, the assistant pastor at Cogatha Missionary Baptist Church on East 93rd Street, unload food pantry items from a truck at the church. He testified during the trial and said that Christopher seemed calm, although he did tell him that he had been working odd jobs and was frustrated that things weren't going right for him. His testimony would be followed by testimony from 19-year-old Kenneth Chambers, who said that he had witnessed the abduction of Aliana. He lived in the area and was waiting for a school bus when he saw a man grab Aliana as she walked along East 93rd Street near Fuller Avenue. He said that his first thought was to call police, but then decided against it because he was unsure of the relationship between the two people and thought that it could have been a father and daughter. Is there something interfering with your happiness, or are you apprehensive about reaching out for help? BetterHelp is here to help you and their today sponsor of Morbidology. BetterHelp is not self-help, it's professional counseling available to you online or over the phone. BetterHelp is more affordable and accessible than traditional offline counseling, and they offer financial aid. Sadly, sometimes traditional offline counseling is not locally available for everybody, but BetterHelp is available for clients worldwide. They have licensed professional counselors specializing in a broad variety of areas, including depression, sleeping, self-esteem, grief, and much more. Everything you share with your counselor is confidential and they are matched to your specific needs. I want you to start living a happier life today. As a listener, you'll get 10% off your first month by visiting our sponsor at betterhelp.com/morbidology. Join over 1 million people who have taken charge of their mental health. Again, that's betterhelp.com/morbidology. The prosecution would present a videotaped confession as evidence. Initially, Christopher had repeatedly changed his version of events of that morning. He first of all claimed that he had been inside the abandoned home doing crack cocaine with other people, but claimed he had nothing to do with Aliana's murder. Investigators continued to press Christopher for more information, before finally revealing that they had linked him to Aliana's body via DNA. Christopher realized that there was no way to get out of this one and admitted that he had killed her. He stated that he was high on crack cocaine at the time of the murder and his memory was hazy.
If I was to tell you that we found your DNA inside the house in the upstairs, would that surprise you?
Probably through the kitchen, maybe.
What did you do is what I'm asking, Chris.
I don't remember what I did. I just remember when I came through that it had happened and I was just disgusted right now with myself. I turned around and it's like I punched her, but then it's like after that, it's like a blur. It's like I almost blacked out or something. People are going to look at me like a monster. I'm not a monster. I'm just an addict that made a mistake. What shouldn't have happened?
Seemingly, midway through Christopher's confession, he realized the gravity of what he had done.
The world is going to hate me now and she never had a chance to grow up, never had a chance to experience anything, and I took that away from her, and there's nothing I can do to bring her back.
During the videotaped confession, Christopher said that people were going to look at him like he was some kind of monster, but said that he wasn't a monster, but instead a drug addict who made a mistake. At one point, he appeared more concerned about his own reputation, and told the investigators that he didn't want his face plastered across the news.
I was so high and I was so out of my mind and it was like I was out of character and I got what I got coming and I deserve it. I will write a formal apology to her family that they probably don't want to hear, but I will do it anyway. I don't want a circus made out of this. I just want to go to court and get it over with.
The defense would present no evidence and no witnesses, but that was to be expected due to the fact they essentially said that Christopher was guilty during their opening statements. During closing arguments, the prosecution reiterated their belief that Christopher had been walking up and down the street, hunting for a victim when he came across Aliana. They said that he abducted her, took her to the abandoned house he had been to before, raped her and then methodically used tool after tool to bring Aliana's life to a grisly ending.
He took her innocence. Ladies and gentlemen, in our great nation, in the United States of America, we have faith that our most prized possessions, when we put them on a bus on their way to school, we have faith that they are going to get there. We have faith that our children are going to be looked at. Whether it's by you, by walking them to the bus, and giving him that last hug and kiss? Or it's by our community members who are out there. But there are those who are hunting. Those who are searching. Looking for prey. Those that hunt and prey, they do so on the smallest of us. On the most vulnerable of us. On our children. On January 26, 2017, Christopher Whitaker set off in search of his prey. This is not a random act, ladies and gentlemen. This is not the work of a spur of the moment. This is not something that just happened. This is prior calculation and design.
Defense attorney Fernando Mack told the jury during their closing arguments that they had waved the white flag, that there was nothing in the world that could justify what happened to Aliana. He said that Christopher never asked for a lawyer, voluntarily gave a sample of his DNA, and told police where to find the clothing he wore during the attack. He asked why, if Christopher had acted as methodically as the prosecution suggested, then why didn't he clean up the crime scene and get rid of the murder weapons? The jury were sent away to deliberate, and unsurprisingly, they would find Christopher Whitaker guilty on all 10 counts. The sentencing phase would follow, and the jury would need to either recommend that Christopher be sentenced to life in prison or be sentenced to death. His defense team wasted no time in attempting to save his life. They hired a psychologist who would say that there were three major issues in Christopher's life, which led him to the murder of Aliana. His mother had died when he was just 8 years old. He had no father figure, and he watched his older sister constantly being abused by her older boyfriend. Dr. Robert Kaplan said that if any of those three things didn't happen, then they wouldn't be where they were today. Christopher was the youngest of 7 children. His father was absent throughout most of his life, but he was close with his grandparents. When his mother died when he was 8 years old, his oldest sister took over as the caring figure of the family, and she moved the family to live with a great aunt in Cleveland out of fear Child Protective Services would remove them. Social worker Cece McDonald said that in a matter of days, Christopher's life was completely turned around. Shortly after the family moved to Cleveland, Christopher's sister's boyfriend began to physically and verbally abuse her, and he had no shame in doing so in front of her siblings. According to the social worker, this left Christopher feeling helpless to protect her and was very likely desensitized to the violence. However, under cross-examination, the prosecution pointed out that all 6 of Christopher's other siblings were exposed to the very same things that Christopher was, yet none of them turned out the way he did. Eric Summers, Christopher's older brother, would tell the jury that when growing up, Christopher was very attached to his mother and was a bit of a loner. Eric said that he himself got involved in drugs and had tried to protect his younger brother from that life, but he was unsuccessful. He said that the family had tried desperately to help Christopher as his life began to spiral out of control. They tried to help him get a job, but he got involved with the Folks Gang, which was an offshoot of the Gangster Disciples. From 1996, Christopher's trouble with the law began. Eric would say that while Christopher spoke about his other crimes, while he accepted that he was guilty of the murder of Aliana, it was something he refused to speak about, telling people that when he thought about what he had done to her, it made him become suicidal. Several other experts would testify that Christopher's long-time addiction to crack cocaine had impaired his impulse control and decision-making. However, under cross-examination, the prosecution pointed out that while Christopher was in prison before, he had racked up more than 40 rule violations, and there was no evidence that Christopher was actually high on crack cocaine at the time of Aliana's murder, and that the experts were just taking Christopher's claims of being high at face value. A defense psychologist testified that Christopher had disassociated from his actions, but a psychologist hired by the prosecution rebuffed this and said evidence did not show that, and that he had changed his version of events several times, and had even expressed a lack of remorse during a recorded phone call from jail. During that phone call, he had said, "When I come walking out of this motherfucker, I'm going to tell everybody to kiss my ass. I ain't gonna show no remorse, no nothing." On the second day of the sentencing phase, Christopher was given the opportunity to speak. It was an unsworn statement which did not open him up to cross-examination. He read from a prepared statement and apologized to Aliana's family.
It's a prepared statement to read to the jury.
Yes. From the beginning, I've accepted full responsibility for my actions. I assisted the detective as to where to find my clothes and boots I was wearing that day. I never wanted this to happen, and ever since that day, I've been filled with regret and remorse. Through the year, I made a lot of phone calls, and in those calls, I've said things and lied about things in order to protect my family's feelings. I've admitted to my guilt to the detectives and to my lawyers. I asked my lawyers not to contest or challenge anything in this case because I really wanted the DeFreeze family to have closure. I will not try to hide behind drugs or alcohol. I will not pretend or lie because it wouldn't be fair to the family. I apologize to the family and the community for my actions. There is no excuse for what I've done. I can't imagine the pain the family feels, but I know the pain I felt when I had to look at what I've done. If I could go back to that day in January, I'd change everything, but I can't, so I have to live with each day with the shame, hurt, and guilt. And although the trial is over, the regret and painful memories will remain with me. That's just things I can't shake. I pray that the family can find peace and she can find rest. And my apologies.
Aliana's family were also given the opportunity to provide impact statements before the sentence was handed down. Her father, Damon, took the opportunity to address the issues regarding women and children being targeted by sexual predators. The heartache in his voice is audible.
It takes a real monster to take a child who's going on her way happily to school. It happens too often. Every time I turn on the news, read the paper, there's a child missing. Not only child, there's men and women missing also. It gets frustrating. And nothing's being done about it. I know the officers you're doing, you can only do for so much. The administration at City Hall needs to address these issues like you addressed the renovation of the Q and like you addressed the Republican Convention. Our children mean a lot to us. They might not be your children, but they mean a lot to us. The 93rd is a safe haven for sexual predators like this monster behind me. And you're lucky I'm not the same person I was 25 years ago because there's not enough police in here to stop me. And you need to know that. And when you get where you're going, you're going to get what you got coming. Before you get to that gas, that lethal injection chamber, my baby didn't have a chance. No grandchildren, can't walk her down the aisle. When she'd come over on the weekends, on Fridays, we'd have this same talk about this guy back here. I warned her of guys like that. I warned her of the abandoned buildings. I told her to watch out for these predators. I didn't want her catching two buses to school. I stressed that. This is what I get. She would talk to me, "Daddy, you showed me how to fight. I'll be okay, Daddy." I said, "Baby, listen to me and quit running your mouth. Don't walk with your hood on your head. Don't have the earbuds in your ear. Be aware of your surroundings." She kept running her mouth and I grabbed her. I said, "That's how it's going to happen, Aliana." I said, "That's how it's going to happen. Now what you going to do?" "Wow, Daddy, you scared me." I said, "Yeah." Lord, give me strength to continue on with this foundation to keep my mind right and my spirit right. It's excuse me so I can look at this bitch-ass dude.
You're addressing the court, Mr. DeFreeze, not
the I said enough. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Before the jury were sequestered to reach their recommendation, the prosecution said to the jury that the brutal circumstances of Aliana's murder should outweigh any of the mitigating factors. Prosecutor Awadalla reminded the jury that Christopher's confession only came after he was informed that his DNA had been found on Aliana's body, and even then he claimed that Aliana had went to the abandoned home with him voluntarily, had sex with him consensually, and then that he didn't remember using any of the tools on her. He had also maintained to his family that he was innocent and expressed concern about his face being splashed across the media. He said, "Do better than what Christopher Whittaker did to Aliana. Give him death because that is better than what he did." Defence Shaughnessy said that Christopher's confession and expression of remorse, as well as his childhood, should be enough to spare his life. He also said that if they decided to impose a life sentence, Christopher's life in prison would be void of hope. The child molesters and child killers were the lowest in the prison hierarchy, and that his life in prison would be lonely and dangerous. The jury would now need to weigh whether the aggravating circumstances of the crimes outweighed the mitigating factors of Christopher's childhood and drug addiction. They needed to reach a unanimous verdict, which meant that if just one juror decided that a life sentence would be more appropriate, then Christopher's life would be spared. It took them just 6 hours to return with a recommendation.
After weighing all of the appropriate evidence, the mitigating factors, and all statutory and non-statutory factors, it is the decision of the court that the aggravating circumstances involving the aggravated murder of A.D. outweigh the mitigating factors beyond a reasonable doubt. In fact, the mitigating factors presented pale in comparison to the epic barbarity associated with the three proven aggravating circumstances. Therefore, the court imposes a sentence of death upon Mr. Whittaker as to count 4 of the indictment.
They recommended that Christopher pay the ultimate price, death. Judge Carolyn Friedland read the jury's recommendation out in court, and it was now up to her to decide whether to impose the jury's recommendation of death, or instead sentence Christopher to life in prison. Ultimately, the judge would follow the jury's recommendation and sentence Christopher Whittaker to death. Outside of court, Aliana's family revealed that they had been hoping that Christopher received a life sentence without parole.
"We didn't get the verdict we wanted. We preferred life without the possibility of parole, but we respect the judge's decision. It's not over. It'll never be over."
The month after the sentencing phase, the Ohio Senate would pass Aliana Alert, which required schools to notify parents within 2 hours if a student fails to arrive in class and does not have an excused absence. During a press conference, Senator Sandra Williams said, "Time is a very important factor in finding a missing person. Senate Bill 82 does not aim to blame school districts for what happened to Aliana or other missing children across the state. It is simply designed to make sure that across Ohio, parents are made aware when their children are not in school and can take quick, necessary action to find them if they do not know where they are." The following month, EPREP and Village Prep Woodland Hills planted a garden in Aliana's memory. In the garden is a boulder with Aliana's name etched onto the surface and surrounded in purple flowers. Her father, Damon, said, "It was a beautiful gesture established by the superintendent and his staff. We appreciate the students and all who were involved. It is beautiful and it will always be her memory left there at the school, and that means a lot." Shortly thereafter, 10 Cleveland police officers and investigators were honored at the annual Community Relations Award ceremony for their bravery and dedication to the case. In December, the abandoned home where Aliana was murdered was demolished, bringing some closure to her family. The following month, Aliana's parents filed a wrongful death lawsuit targeting EPREP and Village Prep Woodland Hills for not notifying them of their daughter's absence. The suit read, defendants have tried to cover up their fatal inaction by claiming that they sent Aliana's mother a message notifying her of Aliana's absence, but that the system malfunctioned. Upon information and belief, defendant's school system have lied about their action of sending a message. The lawsuit was seeking for punitive damages and relief from pain and suffering and more. Ultimately, however, the Ohio 8th Appellate District ruled in the school's favour and determined that they were not liable for Aliana's death. In April of 2019, the Aliana Alert went into effect. Aliana's family would also establish the Aliana DeFreeze Make-A-Change Foundation. Their goal is to provide transportation to children from families who are indigent and who struggle to make ends meet. They also seek to demolish abandoned buildings throughout Cleveland or restore them to livable conditions.
Today is the year anniversary of our baby's passing. We come here today together to honor her, to cherish her, to help her legacy live on. Today was a hard day to even get up. My wife and I, we look for every reason possible to cancel this. But we know we serve as an inspiration to others to make them strong through tragedies such as this one. In Aliana's death, the Aliana DeFreeze Make a Change Foundation was born.
Amen. Mm-hmm.
Amen. And through this foundation, we will make change in the city of Cleveland.
That's right. That's right.
We look forward to protecting our children and providing transportation to our children, education our children about safety awareness, going and coming to school. We hope that you'll support this foundation and continue to support us as we fight this fight every single day. Aliana just wasn't a DeFreeze child. She was a City of Cleveland child.
All right, all right.
All right, then.
And we ask that you please continue to keep her and all of our children in your prayers.
That's right, that's right.
They need to be protected every day, all day. Maybe this tragedy was used as an eye-opener. Maybe it was used to activate us, the community.
The abduction and murder of Aliana DeFreeze disturbed Cleveland and the rest of the nation to the very core. It brought the city together in a bid to inspire change, to better protect children, would eventually lead to the implementation of Aliana Alert. The alert is a precautionary measure to ensure that each child is safe, especially those who travel to and from school alone. While this alert would sadly not have saved Aliana, it could have led to her being discovered much sooner, and it would protect future children in potential danger. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so, so much for listening. I'd like to say a big massive thank you to my amazing new Patreon supporters, Rebecca and Dawn. The support on Patreon truly goes such a long way and makes Morbidology what it is. It helps to defray the cost of freedom of information requests, hosting, archive subscriptions, and much, much more. In return for your support, you get Morbidology merch, exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, which aren't on the regular podcast platforms, bonus content from some episodes, as well as ad-free and early release episodes. You can even request a case for me to cover on the podcast. If you'd like to join Patreon, just click the link in the show notes. I'd also like to remind you that I've joined the app Stereo, and I've been doing live streams on True Crime. Just click the link in the show notes, download the free app, and you can join in on any of my live streams. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, Behaving Badly. Until next time, take care of yourselves, stay safe, and have an amazing week.
We all love a good true crime tale, whether it's yet another retelling of the Ted Bundy murders, or the super convincing con artist, we can't help but be fascinated. Hi, my name is Joe Schwartz, and in my podcast, Behaving Badly, Tales of True Crimes and Other Misdeeds, I will be telling stories ranging from infamous killers like Ted Bundy to cybercriminals such as serial hacker Kevin Paulson, as well as legendary outlaws like Billy the Kid and legendary lawmen such as the untouchable Elliot Ness, and even stories of public events gone horribly wrong, such as the time the Cleveland Indians held their 10-cent beer night promotion in 1974. Because how can making it easy for 20,000 angry sports fans to get more drunk possibly go bad? Well, listen to Behaving Badly, Tales of True Crimes and Other Misdeeds to find out, coming soon on your favorite podcatcher.